G'day expats, welcome to another episode of Expat Chat, episode 29. Today I'm joined with my colleague and friend, Brett Evans, who's the Managing Director for the Europe, Middle East and Africa's region of Atlas Wealth. I'm myself, James Woodley, Managing Director for APAC region. How are you going, Brett? How's the sandpit treating you?
Well, thanks, Matt. Well, thanks. Another day in the hood when it comes to, yep. I think, there's a lot going on. You know, both regionally and internationally, and it's interesting here. Obviously, we're going through our summer break at the moment, and there was a bit of an exodus out of Dubai. People just need to travel, and there's a lot of destinations you can travel now to Dubai out of Dubai. But also, there's still a bit of nervousness. There's still quite a few people, more people than normal, hang around over summer. We had a bit of fun. Our daughter said, "Where are we going for holidays?" And I said, "We're moving down the road." Yeah. And they're like, seriously, where are we going? So, no, we're actually moving down the road. So that was our summer holiday, moving house, which is a bit of fun. But, I think, I mentioned before our call, they announced in the weekend a lot more restrictions have been removed in terms of capacities at events and those sort of things here. So our numbers are down to 1,100, which is, or 1,150, I think it was, which is great. Powering on.
Yeah, I mean, you guys are doing well, and Australia just seems to be slipping backwards at the moment. I mean, we did really well last year, but right now most states are sort of in their own little lockdowns or, in their circuit breakers. New South Wales is in hot water, probably tranching up or tending up towards that $500 active daily case. I think they are going to beat Victoria. And I think realistically, they'll probably be in lockdown towards the end of the year, maybe Christmas. And then, something we'll talk about before the call is, listen, everything that's going on in Australia right now, this could be sort of that W-shaped recovery that you see. I think we'll get probably GDP results soon. And I suspect that, we'll slip back into that recession. Sorry. I think last year we went into that quickest recession recorded in history, but I think
measured in weeks.
Again.
That's
right. So I think that's very likely. Again, the issue is that a lot of SMEs, they're just not getting that cash flow, that support from the government that they need right now. And now that there is no safe harbour rules around insolvency, a lot of businesses are going to be going bust. I mean, every night when I'm watching the TV, your Channel 7s, your Channel 9s, your ABCs, they've always got sort of a show on, talking to the business that are struggling and, up in arms about obviously the government not doing more right now. And I suppose a lot of state governments, their main solution is just getting on with trying to roll out the vaccine. And they said that, that is the only solution we have right now. The cash might not be there to obviously feed out, or they've just sort of bungled the rollout of, a new round of stimulus.
I think it all comes down to access to vaccines. And Australia doesn't have it. We've got, a bun fight around the world, but what I think the Australian government didn't realise the other governments were doing around the world were everyone was hedging their bets. Every government was putting orders on for both Moderna, Johnson & Johnson, Pfizer, AstraZeneca, the whole gamut. And by doing that, they weren't sure who was going to be the first past the post, but we've got good access to it all. Australia sort of took a very much a, supply issue. If we can manufacture our own supply, then we don't have supply issues. The problem is what they forgot was the fact that there wasn't any degree of certainty that AstraZeneca was going to be the one. And what they did was half right in terms of backing AstraZeneca. They should have been backing Pfizer at the same time. And now we're getting shipments in from Poland and all sorts of stuff to support it. And, while it's good that that's happened, it may be too little too late.
Yeah, that's right. Say before the call, I'm getting my AZ first shot next week because it just seems like we've got all these AZ, obviously, vaccinations here, but due to the way that the state governments have handled the rollout, no one's getting the AZ shot. So all these vaccinations actually could expire, which just seems ridiculous, to be honest. I mean, AZ is actually a really, really good vaccination. I think it's just the way it's been beaten up in the media, unfortunately. And if we're
wife's a pharmacist and she got it,
Yeah.
She knows, she's forgotten more about this sort of stuff than I would ever know. And that's the thing. I think if you understand it and understand the numbers, the numbers, one in a million chance of getting a blood clot. whereas a lady on the pill has one 5,000 chance.
Yeah, that's right. And I think I was reading a stat that over in the UK, I think it was four.
And don't quote me on that number. That's just off my memory. So for those out here, epidemiologists and those sort of stuff, you probably go, he's wrong. But just,
anyway. This is a really good opportunity to do that fun little disclaimer that we like to throw in.
This disclaimer, all information, including epidemiology and stats that we refer to in this call, should not be used for any medical advice, let alone financial advice. And please speak to a professional, certainly someone with a stethoscope or a clipboard.
yeah, exactly right. Listen, we won't quote facts and figures or stats on the vaccination, but it just seems like Australia's obviously stuffed up. They did the wait and see last year and it worked towards the end of the year, but now we're in a bit of hot water where wait and see hasn't worked. We weren't hedging our bets. We sent in a junior, I suppose, political person to deal with Pfizer, and obviously they didn't handle that very well. So ScoMo really effed up there. So we had.
I love the rollout. They call it a strollout. And I believe the words Scott Morrison said, "This is not a race," are going to come back to haunt him because it is a race.
Just the fact that it got publicised that Kevin Rudd had to step up and help out. It's just like, oh my gosh, Kevin 07.
Kevin 2021.
That's right. He's making it. That's right. Imagine if he made a race for it. But I guess today, a few topics to talk about. Probably one of the most recent that's come out, which is just causing a bit of a stir. I know my WhatsApp's blown up heavily with a lot of clients and also just on emails about, if you're a returning expat, you might actually get caught back in Australia and you might not be able to leave. I mean, have you read this from the Minister of Health, I think, released a statement and it's been updated in the Act?
He was very, very quiet about it. But read it, and I'll also have experienced it as well. Those who have been on the podcast and the videos for a bit over a year now remember that my wife and daughters were stuck back in Australia from March through to June last year because the UAE closed their borders. And in order for them to get out, we had to actually do this. We had to actually apply for them to leave. Even though in the legislation it did say if you are ordinarily resident overseas, you have an automatic exemption. The problem is the legislation said that, but the actual coalface, the border force officers at the airport were insistent that that's not the case. And they said that the wording's misleading and people were missing flights, people because they weren't applying for an exemption. I don't like to leave things to chance, so I applied for an exemption, submitted 10 megabytes of documents to show that my wife and daughters are ordinarily resident overseas and got approval. Mm-hmm. Fast forward the last 12 months and it seemed to be the issues of border force officers at airports knocking people back were reducing, but then they were still there. They're still different depending on what airport you went to and person you met. They either had no problems at all, I can see that you've got an Emirates ID, you've got a residency visa and here's your utility bills, that's fine, like a phone call, but others were being held for 2 or 3 hours and there was no consistency across the board. Now the disappointing thing is it's not actually the fact that the rules have changed, but it's the possibility that they could reject you from coming back overseas. Now the only chance that I would have in terms of coming back to Australia, not that I can because the first available flight is a business class flight for $25,000 US in October. That's how bad the flights are, but even if I were to do that, just the slim possibility that someone sitting on a computer could say no and not return. I guess that's what's really got most expats quite concerned, because we have seen cases, and I've seen cases personally, of people being rejected to have an exemption to go overseas, and their livelihoods overseas, their families overseas, their whole lives overseas, and it comes down to the click of the button. And what they've done is they've then reapplied and then got a different person and gain exemption. So it's almost like that rule of talking to call centers. If you don't like the response, hang up and call back. But it is playing Russian roulette with your ability to move around. Now the government came out and said we're doing this because people are tripping back and forth. I would love to see the numbers. I reckon that would be 1%, 2%. I know people who've gone back and forth but not multiple times. And to me, it's probably a very small minority, and they don't have any way of stopping them doing that. So, you know what, let's just take away that ability to rock up at an airport and get automatic exemption, and they have to apply to us. So for those 1% or 2% of expats who are doing it, we can stop them. Unfortunately, like with all government administration, the other 99% pay for the price of the 1-2%.
Yeah, that's right. And it seems like now that they've brought this rule through, and it's, I suppose, you know, they've actually put pen to paper, before you even come back to Australia, make sure you, you know, you've been on that travel exemption portal, you've got that certificate, you've printed it out, you've put it in your passport pack, those sort of things. Otherwise, you know, obviously one of the Border Force employees is just going to hold you up and go, hey, no, you can't go. I know there's a transitional period for release, though.
Early September, date, so. I think 7th of September, yep. I think it was. But here's the day-to-day operational problem with what they're proposing. So they're saying you can apply for an exemption before you even fly back to Australia.
Yeah.
But the problem is there's no certainty of people getting on those flights. So on a daily basis in my WhatsApp groups and Facebook groups and everything, there are people getting bumped. So this is the problem. And like I said before, if you get bumped today, you may not get a flight until November, but you can only apply for a maximum of 2 months out. So do you apply for an exemption? And then if your flight gets bumped the next day, and you can't travel for another 4 months, then can you apply for another exemption? This is where it falls over.
Obviously, I mean, it's ridiculous. I know it's a lot that's a lot of this has been talked about on a lot of those Facebook groups, and as you said, those WhatsApp groups, where again there isn't much clarification on these what if scenarios. You know, they don't really have a fact page about if you're getting bumped, because obviously they need to do their spacing within the flight.
Well, they're sitting in Canberra. They don't know this happens to people on a daily basis. That's the problem. There is no engagement of the coalface in terms of, you know, okay, here's the problem we've got. How do we fix it? And what do you guys think? There's none of that. It's all about, you know, okay, well, this is where we're going to do, and let's hope it's right.
Yeah, that's right. Listen, I'll drive this conversation now into another important topic now that we're in a new financial year. And it's not something which I'm making an assumption, but a lot of expats don't care too much about their super and how much they can contribute.
I knew you were going to talk about super,
But I'm a big advocate for super because I don't know too many other vehicles or retirement vehicles in the world which is as tax efficient. You know, maximum tax rate of 15% on investment earnings, or I suppose some types of contributions, and then long-term capital gains only 10%. And then, you know, once we've reached our preservation age or our legal access age, normally 60 now, and we're drawing an income stream from it, all tax-free. Investment earnings, tax-free, franking credits, fully refunded back into your super account. The income stream, don't need to report it on your Australian tax return at all. I know, I do Dad's tax return every year, and he's drawing a pension, and that doesn't get included on there at all. So it's one of those things where obviously expats don't pay attention to it, you know, not kicking in anything at all, where, you know, if they kick in a little bit, they can sometimes get entitled to the offset as well, the little,
The $500 a year.
That's right. Absolutely. But now they're in a new financial year, the contribution limits have actually increased. So they finally indexed them, which is good to see. So in terms of your concessional contributions, which are your pre-tax contributions, that's gone to $27,500. Now, do you want to explain what that kind of contribution is, what it normally is?
Yeah, I think it's a good point, because a lot of people, especially expats, don't know what a concessional contribution is. So essentially there's two ways to make contributions into super, pre-tax and post-tax. Now, if you put your Aussie hat back on, when you were living and working in Australia, your employer previously would have paid 9.5%, now 10% of your salary into super. That is a concessional contribution. Now, while you're working overseas, you don't have an employee contributing to super. So it's a limit or an allowance that is unused. And it's not for everyone. You know, pretty much you'd only do it if you had properties with positive cash flow, capital gains, tax events, and those sort of things to offset, because you can claim a tax deduction on it. But to me, I'll take anything. You know, an increase is going to make it my job a little bit easier for clients in terms of getting access and getting funds into super, because I agree with you. You know, it's amazing how when you talk to people about super, there is a bit of misinformation or misunderstanding about it in terms of what you can and can't do with it. But like I said, even if you're not going to live in Australia, let's say you live in Thailand, you know, the ability to receive 30 years of tax-free income and capital gains is a pretty compelling argument. Because so many people, especially the more the older generation, still want to hold assets in their own names. And it's like, that's great. Yeah, that's fine with that. But in retirement, you're still paying tax, the marginal tax rate on any capital gains tax and also any income you're receiving. Whereas, you know, I talk to clients like it's a window, you know, and you're trying to funnel everything through that window until your retirement day. So then everything's there and then out the other side, you know, is now tax-free.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a common theme that I do see with expats, especially expats that are sort of in the age between, I would say, 45 to probably 55, is that they haven't paid too much to their super, too much attention at all. And they've been away for a while and, you know, you're sort of then left for a short period and they want to retire at 60, but a lot of their assets, which they want to use for retirement, to fund their retirement, are outside, whether it's, you know, your share portfolios, maybe a bit of property, those sort of things. You're now giving yourself a window of maybe 5 years to try and squash or fold it in, but you've still got to abide by your contribution cap. So the other type of contribution, which Brett touched on, was after-tax or non-concessional contribution. So again, they've increased his cap, which is good to see. It's not too much. It went from 100,000 to 110,000. But if you're using the bring forward rule and triggering that, you can actually put in 3 years' worth. So that's 330,000, which is good. There are ways that you can technically get in 440,000 that operates with a couple of financial years, but you need to do it in the right order and in the right manner. Otherwise, you actually get hit with penalty tax. So just be mindful of that. Yeah. Again, this isn't advice. This is just general facts at the moment. Speak to someone if you need assistance with that. But that's a common theme. I suppose expats, which are usually 5 to 10 years out from retirement, are then left with the task of, you know, going, shit, I need to get as much into super now in the next 10 years. And
they butt up against limits. That's the problem. You know, they don't realize that you just can't drop $1 million into super in one day.
Yep.
It has to be staged. It's almost like reverse engineering. You need to work out your retirement day and then work back in terms of what you can do between now and then, because 10 years sounds like a long time until you put it into a plan and a strategy and people go, wow, I've used up everything in the next 10 years. Like, yeah, you're done. So.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. And I think the biggest issue is when they sort of use that bring forward rule, it's like, okay, you can't put anything into super now for, you know, this financial year, next financial year, and, you know, the year after technically. So, it's just planning ahead. But again, you know, that's a welcome increase. Hopefully it stays on that tack and, you know, we get back up to those days where you can put in 180,000 again. That was great.
Oh, yeah. I remember the old Johnny Howe days. It was unlimited. I had clients taking out bank loans and putting $1 million into super.
That's right, equity loans and whatnot. Why wouldn't you? I mean, you've got a property that's got maybe worth $1.2 million and it's got maybe a mortgage of $200,000. Why wouldn't you go and pull out, say, you know, 67% of the equity in there, throw it into super, cop the loan for the next 30 years, but you've just ensured that your retirement is secure. Like, you know, you don't need to put anything more into it. So that's right. Yes, those days are now gone. Another item that I wanted to talk about was estate planning considerations for expats. So, you know, I won't go into this topic too much, but it's mainly around wills and certain assets that you're receiving. So this isn't just for an expat specifically, but this could be having that conversation with a parent or a significant, you know, other, that's in the event they're going to pass away and you are going to be gifted some sort of assets. Having that conversation and around how, if you're a non-resident for tax purposes, well, different asset classes are treated very differently. A good example and an easy example is when they abolished the main residence exemption. You know, now that they've abolished that main residence exemption, well, expats are only given a limited time to make a decision on when that should be sold. If they don't, well, they're going to be biting a lot of capital gains tax.
If it's 2 years and 1 day, it could be a monumental difference in tax.
Absolutely. And cash is okay. Cash is, you know, not something that obviously is normally taxed. I mean, if you're in a country where you need to declare inheritance assets, I know in the US, as an example, even if you're receiving an inheritance from a non-US citizen or non-US tax resident, well, you still need to do an information return to declare those assets. It's not tax. It's just, hey, IRS, I've received these assets. Here you go. I know you want to know everything about me. Here you go. Here's this notification. The other consideration is shares. You know, shares, when we receive them, it usually triggers what we call CDT event K3, where tax needs to be paid technically on the date that it transfers over to you. Because you're a non-resident, you're technically what we call a tax favorable vehicle. So I guess that's another consideration. So if you know that, you know, in the coming years you are going to receive an inheritance and it's highly likely you're going to be a non-resident, well, you definitely should have the conversation with that individual and say, you know, have you thought about in your, I suppose you will, whether things are going to be made to be fair and equitable? Because if I'm receiving this asset, well, I'm actually going to have to pay a huge amount of tax compared to maybe my siblings or my, you know, whoever's in it. It's a hard conversation to have, but it's something that we've seen come about, especially in the last 18 months. It's been a key theme that a lot of expats haven't been planning for, whether they're the ones that, you know, obviously creating the will or they're inheriting assets.
Yep. No, look, I think it's spot on. And it's something that people find easy to forget about when they move overseas. And yep, when they do move overseas, like, it's like super. It's just, yeah, it's either there or not. But, you know, they don't really think a lot about it. It's more about the now. But it's those key little things that I think when things do go wrong, it just gives you that, you know, that foundation to work upon through a very difficult time. You know, I've worked with clients who have had wills and who haven't had wills. And I can tell you from experience, those who have had wills, it's a far more palatable experience to go through than without a will. And look, you can, you know, there's always that debate about where you hold wills. And, you know, I myself, before moving to the UAE, made sure my Australian wills were all up to date. When it comes to wills, you essentially get a will on the country you hold assets in. Unless you need a guardianship will, like we will do here with our daughters. We don't own any assets in the UAE, but our assets are our daughters, so we'll get a guardianship will to, you know, dictate who would like to look after our kids should anything happen to myself and my wife. But there's other ways you can do the smart things. You know, if it's shares, by holding an account and joint account with a husband and a wife, if something would happen to one, the other one gets it, you know, automatically by way of survivorship. So you can structure things in a way and then dovetail a will into it just to give you that peace of mind. It's something that you just hope you never need. But Murphy's Law always raises its head and always goes, bang, you know, you should have had a will. Because you haven't got a will, I'm going to, you know, slap you this scenario.
Yeah, that's right. And you raised a really good point there before, Brett, about, you know, depending on where you are, countries having different wills, different assets. I mean, normally, you can include overseas assets in, say, your Australian will. But at the end of the day, you still probably need something governing what's going to happen to that asset in, say, the US. You know, your 401ks, technically, they're similar to super in regards to that you should have a beneficiary on there. You know, a death beneficiary nomination should be on there in the event you passed away. And obviously, you know, that 401k provider needs to know, well, who does this get paid out to? There'll be withholding tax, that's normal. But, you know, that's another consideration. Depending on the country in which you're living, sometimes depending on your asset spread, especially if you've got local assets, property, those sort of things in that country, well, you should have something that's going to dictate how that's going to be distributed, you know, to your beneficiaries, to your loved ones. So just something to bear in mind and obviously give it some thought. Another sort of question I just want to raise as we wind it up for the day. Sorry, Brett, I just cut you off there, mate.
No, I was just going to say there was a recent rule change in the UAE, which is great for expats, in that they've said that if you're Australian and you have an Australian will, the Dubai courts will recognise that will. So the only exception that is if you own local property. In that case, you need a DIFC will. So, getting a will is important because you know, even if you don't have a local will, we've seen time and time again, foreign courts will consider foreign wills in the absence of anything else. You know, and you're better off having something there than nothing there.
Yeah, absolutely. Couldn't agree more. I mean, the next topic I was going to drive this into, Brett, was just a query that we got around tax implications of drawing down Australian super into an Australian account when you're living overseas in another country. So, I mean, it's a really common one, especially for expats that are retiring overseas. You know, how's my super going to be taxed? And I guess it's something that we've always talked about. We've always mentioned super is agnostic regardless of your residency. If you're an Australian tax resident, you are not taxed on a normal account-based pension income stream. If you're a non-resident, the ATO is not going to tax you on that, you know, account-based pension either. However, depending on the country in which you reside and I suppose the double taxation agreement in play, you know, that will dictate whether you might have to pay some sort of income tax. I mean, we've seen it a few times. The US is a really Easy.
I was going to say, US is easy one.
IRS doesn't hold back. You know, they'll treat super as one of two trusts, and even then they have a few definitions under each individual type of trust. And I won't go into it too much today, but, you know, that's because the DTA doesn't carve out superannuation, much like the DTA doesn't carve out 401ks, IRAs, those sort of types of vehicles. If you look at the UK, you know, our DTA between the UK, the HMRC will commonly tax you on your Australian income stream from your super. It's not carved out. You do have the ability to transfer pensions between countries through the QROP system, but you're limited to your annual caps. So it's highly likely that, yeah, depending on the country you're residing in, really common that we might have to pay some sort of income tax to that local, taxation authority. I think the real common wording that Brett and I have seen is, I can't even sort of recognize, it's just one sentence where it's saying the contracting state has the right to tax you on that income stream or something like that in the DTA, which means if you're living there and you're pulling an Australian income stream into that country, well, that country can tax you on that income stream.
The ones you, if you are looking for offshore locations to retire to, you know, certainly places like Thailand and Malaysia where they have those retirement visas where they do not tax you on any earnings outside of the country. So therefore you can live in Thailand on a fully fledged proper visa.
That's right.
But if you earn credit interest on a Thai bank account, then yeah, you'll pay tax on that. But any super and those sort of things, you know, is from a tax-free point of view is very appealing. And I think, you know, one of the things that's going to roll out from the pandemic is more of these sort of things. Countries are going to want to embrace people with capital to get that infusion in. And I wouldn't be surprised if you see more and more of those sort of visas like that come out of Thailand.
Yeah, well, I mean, I know over in Europe, they've got this golden visa program. And obviously, you know, it extends to a lot of different countries. But again, you've got to remember that, you know, a lot of the countries in Europe, they're not tax havens, you know, you know, it's a case where, yeah, you have to inject maybe 250 to 500,000 euros into the system by buying property or something like that.
Yep.
But it's not a tax haven. You will still have to pay tax at your normal marginal tax rates, all those sort of things. So people need to remember when you're considering these retirement visas, which is what they are, whether you're moving to a place which has a specific carve out for, you know, low tax rates on your pensions and overseas assets. Yep. Obviously, Thailand is a really good example where it does. I think Portugal might be another one, surprisingly. But your Spain, your Italy's, no, listen, they're not tax havens. You know, they're a great place, obviously, probably to retire, but you're still going to be paying your typical marginal tax rates. They've probably got some nasty inheritance taxes as well.
Italy's another one, too, that there is a lot of confusion regarding how they tax super. You know, we're helping a number of clients right now who have retired in Italy, and every Italian accountant I talk to has a different response. So there is a social security agreement between the two countries, which is what they first default on. It's like, no, this is not social security. This is not a Centrelink or an age pension. This is, you know, an income stream that they've paid tax on previously in Australia that they're drawing upon. And then they don't have the concept of privatized pensions either in Italy.
Yeah.
So it is like double Dutch, and we're sort of slowly bumping our way through a solution there.
Yeah, but it makes sense. I mean, most countries aren't going to have a specific carve out or way to tell you how to treat an overseas vehicle, overseas retirement vehicle in each every country.
The holy grail.
Exactly right. I mean, you know, you look at US, and my default is probably US, but you know, they have a carve out for the UK pension systems, but they don't have one for Australia. But it's because the DTA was done back in, I think, 83 or 85.
1983.
So obviously super wasn't really a big thing back then. There was a lot of private insurance sort of schemes back in Australia, but obviously UK pension system was. So it just goes to show what gets missed, and things always need to come back around and be updated. But I'm still shocked that it hasn't been revised. It'd be good if they just changed to a tax residency rather than citizen basis, obviously, with the US, whether you're residing or not. It's ridiculous.
It is.
Two countries in the world, is that right?
Eritrea and United States. The reason that Eritrea can get away with it, they charge a 2% expat tax. If Eritreans who live overseas don't pay it because there's a regime that is the government in Eritrea, your family members in Eritrea will actually pay it. So that's they enforce it by, you know, strong means. The US enforces that citizenship-based taxation by their power and control. You know, they set up FATCA. Australia would never have the ability from a power point of view to implement something like a FATCA.
I mean, I swear common reporting standards has actually been a big bust, though. I think they actually haven't been able to work out how much they've missed out on. And I think it's something which you brought to my attention many years ago. The best place in the world to hide money.
US.
The US.
Yeah, if you want to hide money, fly into New York, go to Wells Fargo branch, deposit $100,000 in the ATM and never know about it, because the FATCA agreement demands information from countries to the US, but the IRS doesn't have to share it back.
It's ridiculous. But anyway, Brett, listen, I'm mindful of the time. Why don't we wrap this up, episode Expat Chat 29, and I guess I'll speak to you soon on the airwaves, mate.
No, thank you. And just to folks out there, a couple of housekeeping things. Obviously, we really sincerely appreciate those who are giving us ratings and reviews. Really, really, really appreciate it. You know, it helps us get the message out there. As you know, we're not charging for this podcast, so the more visibility this can get, therefore, the more people we can help, just from an educational perspective. Make them aware of the situation, what's going on. They can choose to ignore it, but they're aware. And the only way we can get that message out there is through sharing and reviews and subscribing. So please keep up on that. Obviously, we're now on Spotify as well too, which makes life a bit easier for a lot of folks. Last thing, just a bit of housekeeping as well. James and I found out today both of us are shortlisted for the most significant influential top 50 financial advisors in Australia. We're in the shortlist of 100, and we'll be putting out some documentation on the emails and on our blog post on our website where people can vote for us. So we would sincerely appreciate everyone's votes, whether we know you or not. We feel like we know everyone, but you know, certainly that would help us immeasurably.
Yeah, absolutely, Brett. Well, guys, until next time, thanks for stopping by, and we'll speak to you soon.
Cheers. Thanks, guys. Thanks, mate.
Thanks, guys.